everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Norman Stone on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, World War I, A Short History. I remember that when I was in high school, I didn't like to study very much. I don't suppose I'm unique in that way. And one of the things I particularly did not like to do was read books. But I recall distinctly the first time I encountered the book All's Quiet on the Western Front. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And I remember sitting in class while the teachers were going on and on about something or other, of course I don't remember what, reading this book. I just kind of sat in the back of the class and hid. This book made a very powerful impression on me, and since those days so long ago, I've been very interested in the First World War. So it was with great pleasure that I learned that Norman Stone, who is an expert on the war, had written this terrific short book. If you want an introduction to the war, you really can't do better than Norman Stone's treatment. The book is pithy, it is funny in places, it is tragic in other places, and it has the great virtue of brevity. Norman has real voice. It's something that a lot of historians attempt, but Norman has it in spades. This book is tremendously entertaining to read, whether you know anything about World War I or not. You can read it in a sitting, and I strongly suggest that you do. As you can see, I really enjoyed talking to Norman today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Norman.
Hello.
How are you today?
Oh, could be worse.
Yeah, it could be worse. Yeah, me too. You're in Turkey, of course. Where in Turkey are you exactly?
I'm in Ankara.
Ankara.
You know, I travel between here and Istanbul.
Is that right? Yes. No, Ankara, that's sort of in the center of Turkey, is it not?
Pretty well, yes.
Yeah, my ignorance of, you could write books about my ignorance of Turkey. Anyway, I should tell our listeners today that we're very pleased to have Norman Stone on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, and a very punchy book, I should say, World War I, A Short History, which has just been released here in the United States. As you all know who are listening to the show, I've read the book. I think it's absolutely terrific. Norman has something that many historians do not, and that is voice. I know that a lot of us try to write with voice, but it's a difficult thing for historians to do, particularly in the era of mad empiricism. But Norman actually has terrific voice in this book, and it's a wonderful read for anybody who's interested in World War I, and I certainly am myself. Norman, if I could just ask you to say a few words about yourself before we start our discussion of the book.
Well, now where do I start? it's a funny thing, you know. The older you get, the more you go back to your beginnings. And I'm originally a Scotsman, born in Glasgow in 1941. Actually, in the week that the Germans bombed Glasgow, I think I was born slightly prematurely because of that. And you know, I grew up in Glasgow, and I suppose it was the last days when it was the great imperial city. And we were all sort of trained in Glasgow at that time, beady-eyedly, to contemplate scholarships in Cambridge. And I was very, very well trained for that by a genius of a schoolmaster who produced sort of, you know, kind of beady-eyed scholarship candidates in boxes of 100. And to this day, I can still remember weird French words, which we were trained to use, which absolutely floored the examiners. So we all trooped into Cambridge, and I was bored with languages after a bit, and which I think was probably my fault. I couldn't really handle the sort of literary criticism that was done. And I was always really a historian, and so I switched to history, and started off, you know, when I graduated, I went off to Vienna and Budapest because I'd rather fallen in love with Central Europe. So I lived in Vienna for 3 years. It wasn't a very, very happy time, or indeed at all productive. And you know, I began to get, I'm afraid to say, the what might be described as the Adolf Hitler Prize for putting cyanide in the water supply. I hated that city. Mm-hmm. And much preferred Budapest, which even then, though it was a communist place, was far livelier. And then I got a research fellowship in Cambridge in 65, I can remember going back in the train. It was a 24-hour journey in those days, and thinking, well, you know, I can't really do Central Europe. It's too difficult. And it's either Russia or Germany, and a happy choice. got me to learn Russian.
Mm-hmm.
So I then started writing about the Russian front in the First World War. It took me a long time to do it, but I eventually did it. And then got myself established on the Cambridge ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And started writing more generally about Germany and late 19th century Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave me the job as a professor of modern history in Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Cobb, who's the great historian of the French Revolution, was a close friend of mine. And he said, "Do you want my succession?" And so I said, "Well, yes, why not?" And
yeah.
So moved over to Oxford. But to be frank, it's very, very difficult doing modern European history in Oxford. They're terribly good on English history, and terribly good on classical subjects, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But modern European history was not terribly well sorted out, and not as well as in Cambridge. I mean, the record of Cambridge at the moment in terms of modern European history is spiffing.
Mm-hmm.
The present Regius professor is a man called Tim Blanning, who wrote a book on for Penguin called The Pursuit of Power, which is about the 18th and 19th century. And
mm-hmm.
it asks the question, why did Germany go wrong and what has it to do with France? It's a spiffing book.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I just took early retirement from Oxford and came to Turkey more or less by chance. I got very, very angry about what was happening in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
And was writing about it fairly energetically in the English press. And the Turks noticed it and held a conference in this university, Bilkent, and I arrived. And I liked Turkey from the moment go. You know, you arrive at that airport, you see a policeman in a black uniform with a black moustache and a very grim expression, smoking ferociously under a sign saying strictly no smoking. I thought, this is my sort of place. I've been very, very happy here for the last, I suppose, 14 years now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's
going back to England a lot, but it's a wonderful thing to have in your middle 50s when you can find an entirely new horizon like this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's been a bit of a stomach, frankly.
Yeah, well, that's a terrific story, and I admire you for, you know, kind of keeping vital in that sense, moving on to a new country. I sort of dream that I'll do something like that one of these days.
As soon as there's a lot to be said for it.
Well, I have kids that I have to attend to.
There are a lot of Americans in Turkey.
I have a lot of friends who love it there.
They're the best foreigners. I noticed this with the students who come here. They learn the language. They fit in terribly well. It's quite an impressive performance.
Well, I will.
Whereas I'm afraid, you know, the British have become awfully sort of insular, and the type that go down to the kebab van and they equip themselves with their passports, their helmets.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I come from sort of provinces of the United States, and I know that many of my colleagues do as well, and we're very big on learning foreign languages and traveling abroad. I've lived abroad, and I think the notion that Americans, many Americans, are insular is that is not sort of very cosmopolitan. It's wrong-headed.
Across a very good statistic about the Marshall Plan the other day, that there were about 3,500 jobs were made available in sort of 48 to that sort of period. They got 55,000 applicants.
Really? Wow. Yeah, no, that's remarkable. No, we are always on the move. Americans always on the move. So let me ask you this question. How did you come to write this book?
It was simply a commissioned idea. I must be frank, it was Random House originally.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a series which they sent me a box load of the books published in it, and the idea is sort of, you know, short books on big subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were wonderful. I mean, Paul Johnson's thing on the Renaissance, I remember reading on the bus between Ankara and Istanbul.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific. And then there's Gordon Wood's on the American Revolution, where, you know, you even admire his punctuation. It's a superb little book about a subject which is, of course, obviously enormously important, but which I didn't know too much about. And I was originally booked to, booked into that, and I sent in my 40,000 words. And I must be frank with you. I seem to have made enemies of the diaspora Armenians,
mm-hmm.
because it's not that I'm rampagingly pro-Turkish or anything, but I think there is a, I'm not convinced by the story of the genocide. Mm-hmm. Massacres, unquestionably. Mm-hmm. But there was a bit of sort of mutual massacre going on, and the Armenian nationalists were not, I think, absolutely guiltless.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'd been saying this sort of thing. I'd been terribly rude about some silly book that appeared in the States about the whole thing. And it's just a familiar little rubbishy book. And they obviously had the knife out for me, and they'd wormed themselves into the sort of peer review stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So a report came back on the manuscript saying that the book was sloppily written,
mm-hmm.
that it was full of inaccuracies, and that I should have talked about refugee problems much more. And they sat back and they said, well, there we are. And I was, of course, I'm not an inaccurate historian. You know, obviously one makes slips. But I'm not an inaccurate historian. I knew the book wasn't on that level. And luckily, my eldest son's agent then moved in, and she read it and sold it to Penguin in 48 hours, and mm-hmm. then Basic Books bought it. There are now 10 translations in the pipeline. So I think I can look myself in the mirror and say, I didn't do too badly out of that one, but it was a nasty episode, frankly.
Yeah, that was Random House, you say?
I'm afraid it was, yes.
Yes, no, it's funny. I had a kind of run-in like that with them as well.
Did you?
Yes, I did. I cannot be specific about it, but I had a similar sort of thing happen with them. Yeah, I had a very similar sort of thing happen. Again, I can't be specific about it because there may be lawyers involved at this point. But
I had a
very, 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 very interesting experience with Random House. Yeah. So, I think the it's pretty much all champagne and pearls and caviar for the people at Penguin and Basic. Because I can't imagine that there's a more read book about World War I than this book these days, because it is.
That's splendid of you.
Well, it is, but it's a really you've done a really interesting thing here. And that is, a lot of people know quite a bit about World War I, and I would say the same is true of World War II. But there's, and so they're not so much interested in a detailed chronology of the event itself. They're more interested in having someone who knows a lot about it speak intelligently about it and in almost a judgmental way. I remember I was teaching in Ireland, and I was reading The Economist once, and I was very deep into this kind of mindless empiricism that American historians are trained in. I think I was working on a book that about the it was a statistical analysis of the Boyar Duma in the 17th century, which came out eventually in two volumes that no one has ever
read. I'm going to read it.
No one will ever read it. So I was reading The Economist one day, and they were looking back. I think it was the year 2000, and they were looking back on the 20th century. And I remember the sentence very clearly. They said that I can't reproduce the sentence, but it was something like, all sides on World War I fought the war like lunatics. And I thought, it never occurred to me to use the word lunatics in conjunction with World War I. But, there's something to that. It really kind of opened my eyes to this notion that it's not particularly a bad thing to look back and say, there were some mistakes made here. That the people didn't behave properly. That, because this is it's part of the historian's task to... I guess to put it very strongly, to judge what happened, and I won't say that your book is judgmental, but there's a lot of very forceful statements about people's competencies and desires and goals and their claims to have told the truth and their actual prevarication about various things. I want to start with one thing that I learned in the book. I'm not really a student of World War I. World War II is more of my bag. But one of the things that I didn't know. That is that the historiography concerning the beginning of the war has been completely overturned in the last 30 years. I'm guilty of one of the errors that you cite here, and that is that when I teach and talk about World War I, I usually explain the war as a result of several very severe diplomatic misunderstandings and incidents. But that's not the way you describe the beginning of the war at all. You basically put it on the doorstep of the Germans. Maybe you could talk about that for a little bit.
Yes, I think if you think back to the German generation of around about 1900, I mean, they shot ahead in about 30 years. It is the great European civilization. You go to the University of Berlin for pretty well anything. You know, and there's a, I mean, if you'll forgive me, a little sort of footnote to this. There's a strange little side effect in England on this. The British didn't really believe in PhDs. And they said, you know, if you want to write something, write a book or something. And but it was in 1917, when there was a terrible dollar shortage, the Foreign Office said to Oxford and Cambridge, look, all those Americans will go back to Germany and do their doctorates there. Can't you set up a doctoral program by way of diverting the dollars to England, because we'll need them after the war? And Oxford and Cambridge hummed and hawed and had to be more or less forced into setting up a doctorate. And they said, well, look, you know, it's going to cost you. It'll cost you a grand sum of 8 guineas per teacher per term. And that was about 4 times the average working wage at the time. In other words, the equivalent nowadays is something like $20,000 mm-hmm. or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. And you know, the poor darlings, it's stuck at 8 guineas right up till today. Only now they take PAYE off it. Mm-hmm. So you get sort of £5 at the end of a term. but anyway, back to the main theme. The Germans are, you know, you look at the things like the response of the German professoriate to this war that was broken out in 1914. I mean, all their young students are being mown down by, you know, by British machine guns and the rest of it. And there was a thing called the petition of the intellectuals saying to the government that this is absolutely the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And all 1,000 of them put their names down for it. Only Max Weber didn't. And I think somebody else. And that's the spirit of Germany at the time. Now, if you're looking at things from the perspective of Berlin, you think, well, no, Russia is a great savage place. It's got lots and lots of raw materials. We ought to be able to take over that sort of place, as we did, after all, in the days of Catherine the Great. And you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. In the century, in Russia was really run by Germans. Mm-hmm. All Mayendorfs and von der Palans and whatnot, including mm-hmm. Catherine the Great herself, who was from a principality the size of a small golf course. Mm-hmm. and then you say, well, you know, the Poles, what are the Poles? They're really kind of useless, Polnische Wirtschaft, the Polish farm is a description of a mess. The Czechs have got something, but they're really sort of half Germans if you scratch them. They're very close to the Saxons. The Hungarians are sort of allies anyway. And then there's the great prize at the other end of the Balkans, which is the Ottoman Empire, which you can turn into a sort of Austro-German appendage, if you like. And it's very interesting living in that bit of Istanbul, because I can identify where the old Austrian and German banks were, mm-hmm. in just 2 or 3 streets down from the flat I got. Mm-hmm. And they're thinking very much of a German empire, which will be a force for good, force for civilization. And it's what's getting in the way is this Franco-Russian alliance and the prospect of a Russia getting too strong, so that Germany will be squeezed out in 3 or 4 years' time if they wait for the Russians to build up their strategic railways through French money. Mm-hmm. So they're casting about for something which will create a German Europe overnight. Mm-hmm. Not unlike the present European Union, although, of course, it's a different ballgame altogether. I'm not in any way anti-German over this. Although, by the way, I used to write speeches for Margaret Thatcher, mm-hmm. and I have a terrible time with her quite sometimes, saying, look, the Germans are not that bad. Please don't rant on like this.
Yeah.
I think that's the thinking in 1914. Now, obviously, after the war had been lost, and after all this terrible disaster that overtaken the country, anybody who's got private papers does his damnedest to destroy them. So there's a long, long list of documents which just disappeared. Mm-hmm. I would like to know what happened to the documents of the Prussian War Ministry. I suspect they're still in Moscow, but nobody's ever used them. Mm-hmm. And there must be something there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking to graduate students after this interview. You should send them
Well, I'm actually going to go to Berlin snuffling this out, because there's a very, very good German military research thing which has moved to Potsdam. I've just been reading their account of the Second World War, which is magisterial, and they've probably got an idea what's happened.
Mm-hmm. I see. So then, to put it in rather colorful terms, then the Germans were spoiling for a fight and striving for a European empire. Is that correct?
I think so. Yes, I think you could say that. And they would, rope France in some form or another.
Mm-hmm.
But more or less, and I mean, they would say, look, Belgium is an unreal country. It always was split between France and the Holy Roman Empire. Let's split it again. I mean, Belgium was a sort of useful fiction. You build up a sort of European bloc against the British, and of course by implication the Americans.
Mm-hmm. And so, were they thinking about it when they decided they were going to embark on this war, to provoke this war? Were they thinking about 1870 and that it would be quick, and that they would simply overcome the Russians and then overcome the French, or vice versa?
Yes, and this is another thing that they were. They were so convinced that it would be an open and shut war like Bismarck's wars when it's over in about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how on earth intelligent generals could have come to that conclusion, given that I mean anybody could tell that cavalry was useless and mm-hmm. that fortresses could be smashed to bits by heavy artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And how on earth they could come at a judgment like that? But what's curious about it, is it's terribly like 1941 when they attacked the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
I've just been reading about that this afternoon in this magisterial account.
Yeah.
Here they are, they know they haven't got a war economy which can last even mm-hmm. beyond October 1941.
Mm-hmm.
They depend on getting Russian resources, but they say, as they said, we'll kick the door in and the house will fall down.
Yeah, no, I've read some and of these. I've read some of these documents myself, the German documents in October, really September, October 1941, when they're utterly sure that they've won.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, no, they believe it is all over. It was not all over. One of the stories that's often told is that the Germans sent observers to the American Civil War and saw what had happened there, which was quite a bloody World War I like affair in some ways. But they still felt that they were going to simply knock the Russians out very quickly. And why did they think this? I mean, you just said you didn't know, but I just would ask you to speculate a little bit.
And I think the key thing was knocking out France.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to have thought that if they go through Belgium, that they'll come round to Sydney and they'll catch the French army, they'll trap it against the east, as it were,
mm-hmm.
more or less as in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain kind of fatalism about it that, we might not bring it off, but it's the only chance we've got, sort mm-hmm. of attitude. I think it's perfectly true what you say about the Civil War, but I think they must just have thought, well, these are not real soldiers. They're conscripts, and Gettysburg, the Confederates didn't even have boots.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thing.
No,
I think they don't take it terribly seriously. I'm not too sure about it. I'm strained beyond what I know about.
Yeah, I've always wondered about this as well, because of course hindsight being 20/20 and all, you can just sort of look at the disposition of forces and the weapons involved, and you can see that artillery was more or less the queen of the battlefield and remained so throughout the war, and that offensive actions of the kind that were undertaken in even 1862 or 1870 or even during the Ottoman Russian campaigns were going to be at least in close quarters, and that which they were going to be impossible. But they did not foresee this in any way. I think they were very surprised. And this is what you say. They were very surprised when it didn't end very quickly.
Yes, it's extraordinary to see the tactics used by the French army. They were utterly suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And how on earth could they have supposed that clumps of infantry charging forward in red trousers shouting hurrah?
Mm-hmm.
weren't going to be a prime target, even just for a rifle. From a couple of miles off.
I mean, I think one of the things I teach a class on military history, and one of the things I say to the students, I don't know if it's correct, but I'd like to hear your opinion on it, is that they went in with a tactical doctrine that dictated that the goal of offensive operations was to make the other side break. That is, their lines would be disrupted and they would start to retreat. And retreat is a very difficult thing to do under any circumstances. And this is what had happened, I think, in many European campaigns from Napoleon on, that there was a kind of there was some sort of massive frontal assault and one of the two sides broke. But in this war, almost nobody ever broke. They had developed defense in depth, and when the first lines were broken, then there was another line behind them. Everybody knew this, they continued in this way. It's astounding to me that they did that. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think some of it is to do with artillery. You know, they lay in something like 1,000 or 2,000 rounds per gun, shells per gun, and they think this is an absolutely munificent provision for artillery.
Yeah.
And you plaster the enemy line with these hundreds of shells, which, as a measure of this, I think in the Boer War, the British Army used something like a couple of hundred rounds per shell over about 2 or 3 years, rounds per gun. And the idea that you can have these primitive tactics must be based on some idea that if you pass to the opposite, the enemy line with shell, then they'll run away.
I think that's exactly right. And people will often say about the Civil War, for example, that the primary utility of cannon was to frighten the other side. And it certainly is the case that one of these artillery barrages would be tremendously frightening. It makes an extraordinarily big and impressive bang. But, one of the things they discovered very early on is if you dig a deep enough hole, then nothing is going to happen to you, and it's basically all wasted shell. And that was sort of – it's a very confusing thing in military history, because I think it is one of the places where kind of quasi-cultural explanations, which I'm not a huge fan of myself, kind of come into play. Because in this instance, things like honor and glory and what a man should do and four feathers and this other stuff, they seem to really matter here. And whereas you get to World War II and they don't matter at all anymore. They just don't matter. And people are doing the things what you would expect them to do as rational humans. But here they seem to act very – which is why I think the Economist said that all sides fought the war like lunatics. So let's move on to the first stages of the war and we'll skip the Serbian campaign. The initial German thrust through Belgium. How did it bog down?
I think it's basically a question of transport, that you're marching troops through autumn heat, through the August heat, which was very hot in 1914. You're relying essentially on horse transport. The horses fall ill. The poor things were eating, if I remember rightly, something like 25 pounds of grain a day. As I remember, and you can't supply them with that sort of fodder if you're also bringing up guns and shells and all the rest of it. So the horses had to graze at the side of the road, and they were eating sometimes grain which hadn't properly ripened, which in the end killed them.
Mm-hmm.
So the Germans were advancing at an incredible rate, given the circumstances, men marching something like 20, 30 miles a day in that sort of heat. But they couldn't really keep it up, and I think that was the first thing, where the French are arriving by railway.
Mm-hmm.
Railways moving very slowly, trains moving very slowly, but still troops which are rested and which can get out at Amiens or the lines northwest of Paris, and they're ready for the poor old tired Germans, who were, by the time they reached the outskirts of Paris, they were utterly exhausted.
And then once these, I do like what you had to say about the sort of logistics of the war, and these are things that are never brought up, and I think that you talk about railway platforms, for example, as a measure of as a measure of the ability to move troops. And you also talk about this business with fodder, which was tremendously important because you're right that, as you say, that cavalry were more or less useless, yet they expend extraordinary amount of resources on these things. It's a little bit like what Americans will often say about the German army in the Eastern campaign in World War II. And I always tell people that I can't remember the figure, but the number of horses that the Germans went in with, that is into the Soviet Union with, and it's absolutely astounding. They basically walked in and went on horse before they got the trains running. So, these are very important things. So after they bogged down, does it occur to them immediately to dig these massive trench complexes, or does this develop over time?
I think that developed more or less by accident. Mm-hmm. From right away that the Germans discovered that if they dug a hole, they survived. And then the French started digging holes as well, and the British, until they finally reached the channel with their holes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole thing becomes more and more elaborate, these trench systems, which by 1917 you're dealing with things which are stretching way back 10-15 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Of field fortifications of extraordinary elaboration.
Mm-hmm.
I think they hit on it more or less by accident. Not entirely, because the troops were all given trenching tools. In other words, spades.
Mm-hmm.
They had known about it, but the actual elaboration of the whole thing with barbed wire and the rest of it came as a bit of a surprise. And it's a funny thing to think that barbed wire wasn't even thought to be something with a military purpose, and you weren't supposed to confiscate it if you found a ship carrying barbed wire.
Mm-hmm.
from the States to England.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans weren't supposed to confiscate that ship if it was carrying barbed wire, because it was something that kept cattle out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's funny. I was going to say, just as an anecdote, there are in a little town where my grandparents lived, there's a museum, and the museum has a barbed wire room, which has a historical barbed wire of every different kind.
Yeah,
it's a whole room of different kinds of barbed wire, because here, of course, in the United States, it's a way to confine cattle.
It didn't
occur to us to use it for any. It wasn't used in. I don't believe it was used. No, it wasn't. Mm. It wasn't used in the Civil War, certainly. And I remember looking at the barbed wire room, because it sort of enabled the cattlemen of the Midwest to conquer the area. It's an interesting point. I think.
Yeah.
So then, after the first Battle of the Marne, then the Germans are stopped. A question which just occurred to me, and I'd like to hear your speculation on this, is that it wasn't clear to them at all that the war was a stalemate at that point. And did they make any attempt at all to put out diplomatic feelers, or were they still going for broke?
They're really going for broke, but they did, after a bit, send a message to the Russians through the brother-in-law of the Tsaritsa.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the Grand Duke of Hesse, I think. They sent a message saying, look, this is sort of silly. We can divide things between us.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians just threw it into the wastepaper basket.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Now
they thought, yeah.
I was going to say, let's turn actually to the Eastern Front. Now the Germans did quite well on the Eastern Front in a battle that's sometimes called the Battle of Tannenberg. But isn't that right? Am I wrong about that?
Yes, no.
That's right. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. The war in the East was actually, at least in its initial phases, quite different than the war in the West, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And the first thing is that quite paradoxically, the Russians didn't have the enormous army that everybody expected them to have. They had a population of 180 million,
mm-hmm.
and they should have been able to field 10, 15 million men right away out on usual principles. But it was still quite a poor country, and they couldn't feed the men. And the transport system was still not quite advanced enough to supply more than the sort of army that they put in, which was in the end they had 5 million trained men.
Mm-hmm.
They had a wonderful time with the poor old Russians with the business of universal liability to conscription, because they decreed in 1874 that it's a sort of national good if you take these young peasants at age 20 and put them into the army for 3 years. It'll make them literate. electorate and all this sort of thing and give them national consciousness. And then they discovered they didn't have the money for it. So they drew up elaborate exemption things, you know, the incredibly high physical standards. And they exempted various religious minorities like the Mennonites or, and I think the Lapps as well. They wouldn't conscript, Muslims either, I think. Anyway, they conscripted incredibly generously, and the biggest exemption thing was if you were a breadwinner, in other words, if you were married. Mm-hmm. So on the 31st of July 1914, as mobilization was declared, 2 million peasants got married. So I remember seeing this statistic in the Hoover Institution in Stanford. The war ministry scratched its head ponderously and thought, well, why are these characters getting married like this? Mm-hmm. And finally decided it was because they felt they had a patriotic duty to produce children. Anyway, the Russians were a bit short of men. And the front is, of course, twice as long as the Western Front. So there are great wide open spaces where actually even cattle were grazing. Mm-hmm. And it's possible for the Germans to find an empty space and move into it. Mm-hmm. What you then do when you've moved into it, when you find that you're lacking water and that you can't feed your horses and you can't find the enemy flank and there are no roads and all this kind of thing, that's another matter. But it did mean that the Eastern Front was at least mobile in a way that the Western Front wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I see. So then, so as of 1915, the fronts in both the East and the West had stabilized. And at some point, the British decide that they are going to invade Turkey. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the Gallipoli campaign then, which is very peculiar.
Yes, it's lessons of history wrong.
Yeah, it is.
You're sitting in London. You can see the Western Front, and you can't really move on that. The East, well, there's some sort of promise there, but perhaps if you link up with the Russians through the Black Sea, you'll be able to supply the Russians with something or other.
Mm-hmm.
And then the main thing was, I think they all thought that, by analogy with Napoleon, if they attack Turkey, then it's the equivalent of attacking Spain in the mm-hmm. Napoleonic Wars. That you can supply your army by sea much more efficiently than the enemy can supply his over land.
Mm-hmm.
And you can land more or less at will on any part of the Turkish the Turkish shore, and you're bound to get some way. And then the other thing was that everybody, I mean, it is astonishing when you look at it how very few people on the British side actually said that the Turks had some stuffing in them. And if they'd looked at the results of the Balkan Wars, they'd have seen that after the initial disasters, the Turks did actually hold.
Mm-hmm.
and reconquered Thrace. They'd done badly in the Balkan Wars because the empire was so scattered that it was impossible to defend it properly.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in the defensive, Johnny Turk, as the British knew him, was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only two people in the whole British army, as far as I can see, who actually said this thing is a mistake. The first was an interesting man called Aubrey Herbert, who is oddly enough the grandfather of my son's godmother.
Mm-hmm.
It's a curious coincidence. And he'd been all around the Ottoman Empire and spoke all the languages, and he was quite well connected in London. And he said, "Look, this is silly. Don't do this. You get sucked into something awful." And the other man was a decent old colonel called Doughty Wiley, who'd been a military consul, which was a sort of early effort at peacekeeping in eastern Anatolia. And he'd seen the Turks at close quarters since 1909. He'd actually volunteered for their equivalent of the Red Cross, the Red Crescent. They gave him a gong.
Mm-hmm.
And he was put onto Ian Hamilton's staff as an advisor, and wandered ashore at Cape Ellis carrying a stick. He said, "I'm not going to shoot any Turks." They shot him. He was, I mean, peace to his soul. He was the only other one who said this is a terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So the British wander in with a kind of ludicrous overconfidence. They did the same with, at the other end of the Ottoman Empire in Basra, mm-hmm. when the Indian army landed at the bottom end of the Tigris and marched up and lost a division at Kutil Amara in May 1916. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary, kind of crazy overconfidence that the Turks will collapse, and that's precisely what they did not do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's interesting because I'm kind of a novice historian of World War II, and I know that Churchill would go on and on about the soft underbelly of Europe and how important it was to invade Greece, and so this notion that somehow the southern approach to defeating Germany was the way to go, even Gallipoli didn't convince the British that this was not really quite the right road to Berlin. So it continued. What was Churchill's role in any of this? I don't know.
Oh, Churchill was pushing for it. He didn't like these big plundering offensives on the Western Front at all. Mm-hmm. He could see there was something wrong with it. And after all, he was an imperialist, and the British did walk off with a good part of the Ottoman succession in 1918-19. And Churchill was a good old imperialist. It's important to remember that about him.
No.
Wasn't that? Have you seen Andrew Roberts' book called Masters and Commandos?
No, I haven't.
It's worth having a look at that, but the... about the dissensions that went on about the Mediterranean strategy in 42-43, because the British were themselves divided about it.
Yeah.
And I think Alan Brooke regarded the idea of landing in Greece as lunacy.
Yeah.
And Italy wasn't terribly hot either. I mean, there the Americans were absolutely right.
Uh-huh.
It's a very good book, I thought.
Yeah, no, I would like to read it. I think that Churchill is one of the most, at least in the American context, Churchill is one of the most misunderstood figures imaginable. Because here, of course, he's lionized for all kinds of reasons. I mean, people think that he's, because they only think about basically, the business with Hitler. Churchill's career prior to that moment is largely forgotten in the United States. And a friend of mine likes to say that Churchill was wrong about everything and right about one thing, and we only remember the one thing he was right about.
I'm afraid that's about right, yeah. Isn't it? It's about right.
And he was very right about one thing. So,
yes.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So then the war is at stalemate in 1915, and then there's a series of these very bloody offensives. I can't even remember all of them. Ypres is the next one, or is it Verdun? I can't really remember.
It was the French attacks in Champagne.
Yeah, why don't, maybe you could talk a little bit about those.
Well, oh dear, poor old France. As I wander around teaching in Turkey, I ask them often enough, class, how many of you can do French? Because French used to be the second language here.
Mm-hmm.
You're lucky if you get two people in a big class who can still do French. And mm-hmm. I suppose you have to take the decline of France from those terrible attempts in 1915 to throw the Germans out at bayonet point. And they lost terribly heavily in 1915 with these crude offensives against trying to throw the Germans out of the country. When you think what a great country France is, it's almost unbearable to think of the way that generation was thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's specifically really in 1915, that's when they kept trying again and again and again with very modest British help to do it. And they run into the awful problems that after you've wiped out one front line, there's another front line behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So you stumble forward and.
Mm-hmm. The thing that people marvel upon, after they've studied World War II a little bit is the sort of lack of creative tactical thinking involved. But you do mention a couple of things, and you have one unlikely hero that I'd like to, Brusilov, who I'd like to talk about in a second. But maybe you could talk a little bit about the invention of the walking or creeping barrage, because that does seem to have been a reasonably effective tactic in at least moving several hundred yards.
I think this was a French invention that they'd worked out that if you can walk your barrage forward in such a way that you rain shell down on the enemy reserve line when you're taking his first line,
mm-hmm.
then it means you can occupy the second line as well.
Mm-hmm.
then it means extraordinary organization on the part of the artillery, which was very, very difficult, because guns would drop shells really rather wildly. They weren't standardized, and if the wind was in the wrong sort of way, then you couldn't really do it. But as a principle, the creeping barrage was a very good one. The Germans picked it up and became extremely proficient at it.
Yeah, one of the things, I'm sorry to interrupt, but one of the things you mentioned, yeah, actually, that I think is an important point, I didn't know this, but I sort of suspected, is that it's precisely that these guns, though they were obviously machine-tooled, they all had to be individually ranged, because they were all unique. One would not operate exactly like anybody who spent any time with rifles knows this, that every rifle has to be, it has to be ranged on its own. And I guess the Germans did this. They actually took their big guns out and ranged them. And so they had firing tables for every gun.
Yes.
Which is, that's very German.
But, it's very German, isn't it? Very German.
Yeah, but it was a heck of a good idea. Yeah.
Yes, it was. It was. It meant, you know, when the artillery really came into its own in 1918, there was nobody to beat them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's interesting. So then another innovation concerning artillery was the use of airplanes for spotting targets. And why was this important?
If you can work out a gun position, then you can train your own gun at it and wipe it out. So aircraft became more and more important as time went on, and then of course they were able to fly over the heads of attacking infantry. And so by 1918 you get something like the principles of 1940 coming in, where there will be tanks moving forward, there will be aircraft forcing the enemy to keep his head down, and infantry following the tanks. And the French had it worked out quite well in 1918 with these three elements and the anticipation of 1940. Mm-hmm. And the aircraft became more and more and more important in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I see just what you mean. One of the things that interested me in the book was precisely that the way to get tactical surprise was in fact not to fire spotting rounds, not to send troops to reconnoiter, but in fact send planes to get grid coordinates, the grid coordinates in, and then just start.
Or even better was to, they had some method which I never quite understood, which was sound ranging. They could work out by the sound waves of a round shell where the gun was, and they could simply mark a cross on a gradient. They fire at that.
Yeah, you know what,
they're genius.
Yeah, in the Iraq War, this technique has been perfected with radar. So that I know that in the first Iraq War and in the second Iraq War, the United States, I was told this by an artillery captain actually, that anytime the Iraqis fired a shell, the United States knew exactly where that gun was within seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. It didn't fire any more shells, if you know what
no.
I mean.
No.
That's very. So talk a little bit about this unlikely, you know, because as a Russian historian, Brusilov, he is not, you know, you don't really hear a lot about him, at least nothing very positive. But in your estimation, he's a sort of a, I guess genius might be too strong a word, but he definitely he definitely figured something out that other people did not. Why don't you talk a little about that?
It is just such a relief to find a general with a brain, to be honest, at that time. I think we're a bit unfair generally to the generals, because they were facing an awful problem, but some of them did respond to it quite creatively, and I think Brusilov did. He could see that, look, you can break through, but then your problem comes. That you can't move your troops up, because they're moving, even if they're not fired at, they're moving at the rate of 2 miles an hour over muddy terrain with carrying the equivalent of, I worked out it's about twice what you're allowed to put on an aircraft that they had to carry. So they're not going to get very far if they, in those circumstances, even if you have nothing in front of you. What you've got to do is to disrupt the enemy reserves. And he got the key to that, because he said you must attack on a wide front and in several places at the same time. then the enemy will not know what to do with his reserves, and you've got the chance then to exploit your breakthrough, which they did in 1916. The interesting thing was, I mean, of course it was against the Austrians, and the Austrians in 1916 were dealing with a very, very varied army in which quite a number of the Czech troops, and I think a lot of the Ukrainian ones, were not particularly keen on fighting the war. But there are ways of dealing with that kind of demoralization, and the Germans were usually quite good at it once they moved in. So I don't think the cause of it is just that the Austrians wanted to give up. It's not as simple as that. Brusilov had guessed the method that was eventually going to win the war. When it was applied in 1918 by Foch, he said, you know, you attack here, you attack there, you attack there, then you stop. And the enemy will bring in his reserves. They're in the wrong place. So you attack somewhere else. And then the enemy have to put their reserves into the trains and chug them along. And at the end, in 1918, about half the German army was spending its entire time in trains, moving very slowly, eating buns. It's a very demoralizing way to fight a war.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a remarkable statistic because, yeah, they didn't really know what to do because, you know, it's in a certain sense that the Allies were coming at them in too many different directions. So one of the things that has always confused me, and if someone were to ask me today, you know, how did World War One end, I would think back to All Quiet in the Western Front and say the hero was killed. I really don't know. I never have figured out exactly how the war ceased. And so maybe you could take us through the last few months.
It is a very good question, isn't it? I mean, if you think how the Germans fought on in circumstances which must have, they must have seen that this thing is utterly hopeless, you know, with the Russians over the Oder and the Americans on the Rhine and so on, and their cities being knocked to smithereens. How on earth the Germans went on fighting like that at the end of the war, whereas in 1918 they threw the hand in. Ludendorff says in his memoirs that at a certain point it was just irresponsible to go on fighting the war because it was obvious what was going to happen. And we just had to get the best terms we could. He says that in his memoirs, and I think that's on the whole true. That after all, I mean, it was a different Germany. They weren't monsters at all, whereas the Nazis obviously were. And so they were, at some point a sense of reason did take over in the summer of 1918 when you can see them thinking, well, you know, we've lost. We're going to have to find the best terms possible. Of course, it took time to recognize that and to sort out the politics of it. But in the end, it's when the British broke through at Anya on the 8th of August, 1918. Ludendorff said, you know, that's that. And then, of course, it spreads to the soldiers get the idea, and then there are there's after all the revolutionary element in Berlin. What were they called? The revolutionary Obleute, the shop stewards who are thinking quite seriously of a Russian revolution. And then possibly also, you know, the effect of that quite substantial occupation army in the East, which was really wondering what on earth it was doing occupying the Ukraine at the time. Plus the economic collapse was quite serious. The railways were ceasing to work, and potatoes weren't being delivered to the working class wives in Berlin. And then there's finally this mad thing of the Navy saying, right, time for one last final charge at the Thames, which, of course, causes the naval mutiny, which brought the whole thing down.
Yeah, no, one thing I've always wondered, sort of in terms of grand strategy, is that in a certain sense that, you know, by early 1918, that the German strategy had, in a peculiar sense, succeeded because the Russians were knocked out of the war. And they could turn their attention to the West, and yet that strategy itself proved to be flawed. And I guess the simple explanation would be that the Americans showed up. How much of the appearance of the Americans explains the end of the war?
100%.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And you say, you know, actually you say something rather surprising I didn't know. You say the Americans acquitted themselves pretty well at first. And I, you know, the word on the street over here is that we every time we fight the Germans, we lose until they lose, if you see what I mean.
Well, I mean, I think to start off with, the, you know, various mistakes were made. A.J. P. Taylor is some figure somewhere about that you know, the Americans insisted on being trained in the methods of 1914,
mm-hmm.
and forgetting that you know, 1917 had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another statistic I read somewhere that the American soldiers were trained in firing rifles, and the rifle by 1918 was more or less as obsolete as mm-hmm. You know, as a claymore in the mm-hmm. 1745 rebellion in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just was not a war-winning weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too sure about that. There's a lot of things I want to know about the American Army.
Yeah, I don't, you know, again, I'm not, it's funny because in the United States, there are a lot of books, and I've actually interviewed people about World War I, but it tends to be, and this is not to disparage these themes at all, but they tend to be social historical themes like, you know, women's liberation during World War I, or, you know, black soldiers during World War I, or sort of things that are politically interesting today. But I think that in terms of actual, I'm sure that some military historians are going to contact me about this, but I think in I think in terms of you know, books about the performance of the American military in World War I, I can't really think of any very good ones. But I could be totally wrong.
I did read a very good biography of MacArthur,
mm-hmm.
which was terribly good on his generalship in 1917-18. You know, how he'd go down to the barbed wire himself and look at it, and the sort of thing that generals tended not to do.
Yeah,
he was rather impressive.
Yeah, well, he was an impressive figure. Flawed, but impressive. Can't that be said of all of us, really? Flawed, but impressive. I'm rather less impressive, more flawed. I did want to, you know, the one of the things you say at the end of the book, you know, it's almost hard to believe, and that is that there were a considerable number of people in Germany at the end of the war that felt the Germans didn't really lose. Maybe you could say a few words about that opinion and why we think that today. What did they say? How did they? It seemed obvious they lost. At least it does in hindsight. What?
Yeah, well, yes, but they were. I mean, after all, they were all over the Ukraine at the time, and the evacuation of the German army in the east was quite a doing. They hadn't actually been invaded at all.
Mm-hmm.
The tiny little bits of Alsace, I think, was. Mm-hmm. And they were still in occupation of Brussels and all that sort of thing. And then they, all of a sudden, you know, if you're a kind of respectable German, you see these mutinous sailors advocating with those Bolshevik banderoles, and you see the trade unions pouring out onto the streets in Berlin. You think, well, we've been stabbed in the back by these characters. Curious little example of it. Do you remember the man, the general von Fritsch, who was sacked mm-hmm. by Hitler on a trumped up charge of homosexuality?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might have thought that he would have it in for the Nazis. Apparently, he wrote a private letter not long afterwards saying that, well, now Hitler's done very well with dealing with the workers,
mm-hmm.
but he's got some of the way dealing with the Jews, who are really an enemy. But the thing that he's really got to get at is the Catholic Church, old lunatic.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of Germans in their despair thought like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really quite remarkable because they were so utterly defeated. Was it a mistake? You know, I hate to ask this question because it's not exactly historical, but was it a mistake not to occupy Germany after the war?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think so, looking back on it. I mean, either you treat Germany as they treated France in 1814-15, and you say, right, you know, produce your Talleyrand, we'll deal with you as a power on the same level as us. You've just lost a war, that's all. And either you do that, or, damn, sorry, that's my alarm clock for some reason. Can I turn it off?
Yeah, please do. It's time to get up.
Hope you can edit that out.
No, it's not a problem. I did that.
My cleaning lady was here this morning. She must have dusted it in the wrong way.
That's okay. Those charming, leave those charming little things in. It shows that they're live. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So, treating Germany the way she was treated, that you leave her independent and then you load her with this what looks like a vicious peace treaty,
mm-hmm.
especially the reparations. And then, you know, the occupation of the Ruhr in 1923, mm-hmm. the big inflation, all that. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, it's all well said about it. That if you, I mean, if you treat a dog like this, and then you suddenly let it off the leash, then don't be surprised if it goes straight to your throat.
Yeah, did Orwell really say that?
Yes, somewhere. That guy, Orwell said a lot of good things.
He did really say a lot of good things. Yeah, that Orwell, he's just he's in sort of endless well of
yes.
interesting little statements. So,
yes.
Norman Stone, we have taken up a huge amount of your time, and I know that you have graduate students waiting, and I'm against making graduate students wait. I just want to go on the record there.
I'll tell them that.
Yes, right. So anyway, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. The book is World War One, a Short History, and I recommend everyone read it. I will be using it in a class that I'm going to teach, this military history class, because I think it's just a terrific read. Have you ever read, by the way, there's a book called, it's by a, you know, I can't remember the name of it. I think it's by a German journalist historian called The Meaning of Hitler.
That's Sebastian Haffner.
Yeah, it is actually. Have you read this book? Your book reminded me of his book. I love that book.
Yeah, he's very good.
I absolutely love that book.
Yes,
and
he's
your
very,
book
very
reminded
good.
Me of that. And it is Sebastian Haffner. That's right. So I use that book as well. So anyway, I'll use your book and his book. So in any event, thank you very much for being on the show. Let me ask our traditional final question, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, I think what I'm on the planet to do is to write about Russia and Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So I've started that. Nobody's ever really done it, mm-hmm. and it's a wonderful subject.
It's a big topic.
It's a big topic.
Yeah, it is.
I hope I've still got enough steam in me to do it.
I'm sure that you do. And when you're done, and when you're done with the first volume of it, what I'm sure will be many volumes, you please contact us, and we'll have you on the show again. Okay?
Wonderful. I thoroughly enjoyed that. Thank you.
All right, Norman. Thanks very much. Take care now.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Norman Stone about his new book, World War One: A Short History. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.